Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Correctional Nursing Today on Blog Talk Radio, the show that keeps you current on the happenings in the world of correctional health care. My name is Lori Shonley. It's my pleasure to be your host for the program. I'm a nurse writer and educator with over 25 years of experience, currently specializing in the field of correctional health. Check out my website, correctionalnurse.net, for information, resources, and the latest news. Well, today I'm delighted to have with me author Piper Kerman. Her recent book, Orange is the New Black, is a memoir of her year in a federal women's prison. She's going to be able to give us some insight from the other side. So let's bring her on to the show. Well, welcome, Piper. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there, Lori. Thanks for having me on.
Well, listen, I just finished your book. It's got a little twist at the end.
Yes, it certainly does. It's got quite a few twists and turns in that story.
It does. A very good book. We're going to be talking in a couple of minutes about your perspective on healthcare behind bars. But first, why don't you just tell our audience a little bit about how you ended up in federal women's prison?
Absolutely. I'm sort of an unusual prisoner in that I come from a middle-class background. I got involved with a relationship immediately after I graduated from college in my early 20s. I became involved in a relationship with a person who was involved in narcotics trafficking, and I followed her around the globe and certainly got myself into some trouble, ultimately ended up doing some of the things she requested, including carrying a bag of money from Chicago to Brussels. But fortunately, I think, for me, came to my senses sort of independently and said, I've got to get out of this situation and I've got to get out of this relationship, and made my way back to the United States and out to California, put my life back together, and it was not until many, many years later that the knock came on the door and federal agents told me that I'd been indicted in federal court in Chicago.
Wow.
And that is the...
That was sometime after that. You'd sort of close that off and put that behind you.
That's definitely true. So I was indicted about 5 years after committing the offense and didn't actually walk into prison gates until 11 years afterwards. There was a lengthy delay between my indictment and actually being a self-surrender at the Federal Correctional Institution in Danbury, Connecticut.
Danbury, Connecticut. Okay, so yes, you're a little bit different than the demographic usually seen. They called you, I think, the all-American girl there, a few of your...
Some of the other prisoners would sometimes ask me, what is the all-American girl doing here? And they would laugh, and I would laugh too. Yeah, it's unusual. It's unusual for someone with as much education as I am lucky to have had to be in prison. It's unusual for someone with as much access to good health care as I've always had to end up in prison. Those things are very unusual. So those things were definitely true. I think I walked into prison with a sense that no matter who I met, they were my equals, and that is an attitude that really helped, I think, as those twists and turns happened in the actual story of what happened behind bars for that year. You know, I think that's one of the interesting things about being a prisoner, is one of the things that's absolutely imperative to your survival is fitting in, figuring out where you fit in the social ecology of a prison unit and that setting. And I think that's true for all prisoners.
Yes, yes. Did you find yourself doing things specifically in order to have some commonalities with the other women who were there?
I didn't find that I did really, really specific things other than, you know, certainly those first several months in prison, I kept my eyes open and my mouth shut. And, you know, I just always looked for the things that I had in common with other people rather than the things that made me different. And that's a lot easier, obviously, when everyone's wearing the exact same khaki uniform and everyone's got, you know, eight numbers after their name. Still, though, differences in terms of access to things like education and healthcare are readily apparent to everyone.
Yes, yes. And well, one of the advantages of having that is you've been able to make visible and make real the experience because of the education and background that you've had in producing this book. So, it's
well,
been a great
thank you, Lori. I mean, that's definitely the aim of the book, is to really just try to encapsulate that experience of being a prisoner and help the reader even put themselves in those shoes and try to imagine what being incarcerated would be like for them. And what it is like for so many millions of Americans, unfortunately.
Right, yes. 1 in 10, I think, is the latest figures. And it's so helpful. As I read it as a healthcare provider, I thought this book is certainly helpful for someone coming into correctional healthcare to get an understanding of the experience of the inmate, the experience of their patients, because often the healthcare provider has a disjointed connection with, you know, just episodic. So to understand the social milieu in which they're involved, I think is very helpful.
Definitely, I can definitely understand why that would be important. You know, I have several folks in my family who are physicians, and so, you know, while I was very fortunate to not be very reliant on healthcare while I was a prisoner, it was an area that I sort of turned an interested eye towards while I was a prisoner, just because of some of that family background.
Sure. Well, listen, I was thinking about the information in your book and relating it to a recent study that I read that really identified how important relationship and family is to women in prison. And that's almost like one of these V8 moments, like it's a no-brainer. Well, of course, that would be the case. But what are some of the things that that you experienced or saw in the prison that really brought that home?
Well, it's staggeringly important. I'm sure it's important for all prisoners, the relationships that they have with their family, whether that family is children, whether that family is parents, depending on the age and the situation of the prisoner. It's starkly apparent, though, in the case of female prisoners, because so many female prisoners are mothers, and such a significant percentage, I think it's something around 80% of female prisoners are mothers, and a high percentage of those mothers have primary custody and primary responsibility for their children before they're locked up. So that the impact of their incarceration on that family unit is something that is critically, critically important to those mothers. And you, of course, see a spectrum in terms of people's ability to sort of be effective parents. But, you know, there are a lot of prisoners who are pretty effective parents who, you know, their offenses, you know, obviously have a terrible impact on their families, but not every person in prison was a negligent parent before they were locked up. And so the continuation of those relationships and trying to keep those relationships intact or as close to intact as possible is very top of mind and very, very difficult for many, many prisoners, especially prisoners who have fewer resources. So for a middle-class prisoner like myself, I don't have children, but my family, I was very easy, relatively easy, to keep in contact with my family because they had the wherewithal, and my friends had the wherewithal to come physically visit me, and they were also able to put money into my prison account so that it was able to make phone calls to them and so on and so forth. For prisoners who are indigent, that's a totally different story. And frankly, the more children a woman has, the more children a prisoner has, the more likely they are to be indigent. And so the ripple effect of the incarceration is very, very powerful.
Right. And not having the resources, the facilities, even good writing skills to be able to write letters, to read well, those types of things have got the impact that cause a lot of grief, I think, a lot of grief and stress, I would think, on these women.
A lot of grief and stress on the women, and, of course, have an impact on their children, and that has, you know, that whole sort of chickens coming home to roost question. You know, when we are considering the incarceration of low-level nonviolent offenders, and many female prisoners fall into that category, there's in my opinion, there's a diminishing return in terms of the overall harm that that incarceration may do, as opposed to the social benefit around public safety. So, unfortunately,
right,
I don't think
right.
that's taken into consideration as seriously as it should be.
Definitely. Definitely. And although you weren't the typical demographic, the fact that so many of the women are incarcerated related to drug offenses is that's pretty common.
Absolutely. A huge percentage of women have had some history, whether in the past or in the present, with substance abuse, alcohol, or drug abuse. Often that substance abuse is, of course, related to mental illness, and mental illness is a massive issue for prisoners who
right,
suffer from
right.
mental illness, for prisoners who don't suffer from mental illness, because, as we know, prisons are so crowded. If you are a prisoner, you know, I'm very fortunate. Again, my health is very good. My mental health has always been pretty intact. But, you know, when you find yourself living as a prisoner in a unit with many, many other women who are contending not only with chronic disease like diabetes or heart disease, some of the classic things that you see in the prison population, but also with a full spectrum of mental illness, that creates an extremely challenging dynamic. I can only imagine that is true for a health practitioner. For a prisoner who's living in the unit, what you do is you find yourself working to accommodate the situations, the mental health situations of many other prisoners, because you have no choice. You're living right on top of each other. And what was interesting to me was that there was definitely a reluctance or a skepticism about a prisoner who is having perhaps an increasingly difficult time, about whether they would really get substantive help as opposed to simply getting locked up in SEG. If you saw someone
yeah.
who was sort of cycling into a bad place, there was an incentive, as it were, among other prisoners to try to sort of either help that person or cover up the fact that they were going into a sort of a tough place, because there was the fear that that person's simply going to get locked up in solitary, and that, you know, generally does not have a very positive effect on someone's mental state. So
right.
those sort of social currents are very, very interesting and, you know, frankly, very disturbing to sort of observe and live with.
Well, sure, it's a continuation of the criminalization of the mental illness. It's,
absolutely,
it's being treated as a crime, an offense. We'll put you in the shoe,
yep.
As opposed to well, let's see if we can get you some treatment. And I think even if I remember, your experience was that often the treatment was zombifying some of the individual
yeah.
as opposed to helping them.
Generally, heavy medication treatment, and certainly in the units, particularly in Danbury, the unit that I was housed in for 11 months, you know, there was one staff psychiatrist for approximately 1,400 women. So,
unreasonable ratio there.
Yeah, the ability of that for that doctor to provide anything above and beyond medication was pretty limited. And even, you know, again, I'm not a physician and not a psychiatrist, but I have enough information to know that there's a limited spectrum of medication that's just generally available, as opposed to sort of a finely nuanced delivery of care. And
yes, so the formula is often limited,
sort of,
yeah.
Right, exactly. So, you know, it's sort of a triage situation when you have such a small number of clinicians who are serving such a huge number of people, and often people who are, you know, frequently in crisis.
Yes, and certainly, as you said, the resources that are available are limited and totally inadequate. I think you also found that for the drug rehabilitation, it was fairly limited, even though so many of the women were there for drug offenses.
Yes, it's true. In the facilities that I was held in the federal facilities, there is an intensive 9-month drug program, which by and large, you know, I did not go through it, but its reputation is actually quite good among prisoners. However, it's your only shot at getting into that program is if your judge includes it in your sentence, and there's far more demand for the program than there is than there are seats. So it's a significant problem because it's exactly the type of approach, you know, an intensive long-term, it's a residential, you know, all of the people who go through that program live in one unit together and go through a series of programming. But it's just a tiny fraction of the number of folks who do, in fact, struggle with substance abuse. And I didn't find in the prisons in which I was held that there was a high availability of illicit narcotics or sort of contraband drugs. But the reality is that folks would generally be clean while they were in prison, but would not be prepared to go back on the street by any stretch of the imagination.
Right, returning to their original environments, it would be very hard for them to overcome that.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
That's very true. I think their experience is representative of generally across the board a lack of resources in both mental health and drug rehabilitation. Although there are some prisons and jails that actually have exemplary programs, but not
Absolutely.
As many as we'd certainly like.
Absolutely. Yeah. The other thing that was very interesting to me, you know, from a healthcare perspective, was in the relatively early months when I was first incarcerated, a really incredibly nasty flu ran through the entire institution. And it was really one of those bad flus that sort of takes you down for 7 days solid, you know, body aches, fever, et cetera. And I had never been in I had never been in a setting like that where the population was, so, you know, the population is crowded. I mean, you're right on top of each other. And it was interesting and certainly scary to watch how quickly, literally, you know, almost to the woman, everyone got sick and really sick. And the demands that placed on the institution and on the healthcare staff. So that was very eye-opening for me.
Yeah, in a closed community like that, infection can move through extremely quickly, and that's one of the huge issues in correctional nursing, definitely, is
Absolutely.
To try to contain that, although it's almost impossible on a viral level to do that.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, prisoners, the female prisoners that I was living amongst were generally quite careful about things like, let's say, foot contact or, you know, cleanliness, you know, wearing shower shoes, that kind of thing, like some of the very basic sanitary requirements. You know, I don't know if this is true for male prisoners or not, but the female prisoners who I lived among were pretty mindful of that. But but something like a virus in those close quarters is pretty tough to stop.
Right, and certainly when we were concerned about H1N1, there were a lot of emergency plans being created to deal with something like that at an institutional level. It's really huge.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking about the whole mental health issue, the whole drug rehabilitation issue, family relationship. All of these kind of roll up and have an impact on the whole idea of recidivism, you know, coming back into the system and that cycle and how we've really seemed to have failed in breaking that kind of cycle. Do you have any thoughts on that?
By design, it seems that corrections creates very little, by design, going to prison is sort of like being exiled. You've been exiled from your community. And the problem with that is that there's no continuity, whether you're talking about job and work or whether you're talking about healthcare. There's no continuity between what happens behind prison walls and what happens when a prisoner inevitably returns back to their community. And that's a huge problem. So if you look at something like employment, first of all, most prisoners have not even a high school diploma. There are obviously requirements and some educational programs to provide GEDs. Those GEDs are not usually truly geared towards preparation for the workforce, and there's very little vocational programming that I ever saw or had any exposure to that, again, is geared towards any continuity, towards release, and towards realistic work that the prisoner might be doing. So I, for example, was an electrician and then a construction worker while I was in prison. Both, you know, jobs that I was perfectly good to do, happy to do, and certainly appreciated the ability to sort of make the time go faster and be in a workshop environment, which is a little bit more normal than, you know, sort of sitting in a unit environment. But realistically, you know, there's very few, let's say, female prisoners who are going to become construction workers or plumbers when they come home from prison.
Right.
So the lack of continuity between something like employment, what actually, you know, the work that actually gets done generally to maintain the facility while you're a prisoner, and, you know, returning home, both in terms of building skills and also in terms of real-world continuity, like creating connections, because very few prisoners have what one would describe as a professional network or a real work network, unless they've been working in the you know, the illicit economy, in which case they may have very strong work networks, and that's, frankly, what they're going to return to. You know, people naturally tap into the resources that are available to them, whether they're legal or illegal. So sort of that failure of continuity on something like work, which is, I think, you know, I think work and health are probably the two deciding factors on whether someone returns home successfully or whether someone recidivates. I don't know if recidivates is actually a word, actually.
We'll make it up.
But, and on the healthcare front, you know, there's also a serious lack of continuity. I'm very lucky. My mental health has always been excellent, and I was not participant in any kind of course of medication or anything like that while I was incarcerated. But when you do return home, you know, let's say you are taking psych meds, you know, where are those psych, you know, if you're indigent again, you know, the continuity of care that would potentially help a lot in terms of keeping someone's feet on the right path is generally not there. And even something as straightforward and necessary for a female prisoner as reproductive health care, which, you know, children, the raising of children, the bearing of children is an incredibly significant factor in female prisoners' lives, as we've talked about. I would also say a lack of access to reproductive health care contributes to very large families sometimes, which contribute in some way, directly or indirectly, to folks' inability to stay out of the system. And so that's a big area that I think could be addressed and doesn't really get addressed. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that your experience was in the federal system. I do know in some of the state systems, they've been able to forge some community links, a little less disconnected than in the federal system where you're kind of relocated all over, but with some of the state systems, they have worked on some community links for continuity of care, such things as HIV and you know, some of the other chronic things. But you're right, that whole in and out of the security barrier is kind of hard to continue
definitely.
On with the care.
That's great, and it is sort of an interesting patch. You know, the correctional system is obviously large, diverse. It includes, you know, the federal system, the state systems, county and city jails. You know, it's a real patchwork quilt. And I do think that one of the places where you did see something closest to what you might describe as continuity of care was around folks who had HIV, who were suffering from HIV. And I think that's sort of a community of practice or a clinical practice that has been focused on this population for a long, long time. And I'm sure that there are some practices.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm sure that there are some best practices that have been developed there that could really apply to a broader spectrum of health challenges and issues, for sure.
Absolutely.
You know, I was able personally, you know, a couple months before I knew I was going to be released, I went to sick call, and I was very rarely there. I think I was in sick call for three times, once when I caught that terrible, terrible flu, once when I fell off my bunk and cracked myself pretty badly and just wanted to report it so that there was no question about where those bruises came from, and a third time I went down and said, you know, I'd really like to get on birth control, and this was approximately 2 months before I was coming home, due to come home. And I was skeptical about whether that would happen, but in fact they were completely helpful and,
wow,
and made that happen really quickly, which was very eye-opening to me and really surprising but really uncontroversial in that case. Now, of course, that's not a prescription that I could have carried home. In my case, there was never going to be an issue of whether I'd be have access to adequate health care when I came home, and I did.
Mm-hmm.
But that was sort of heartening to me in a lot of ways, because there was, sadly, a high level of skepticism among the population of prisoners about
mm-hmm.
the health care providers, by and large.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks, like the dentists, yeah. I think, it's the classic, it's a classic situation where there's so many prisoners and they have so many needs that they may feel are unmet, and of course you have a limited number of clinicians in a tough, tough working environment. So that's a challenging situation in terms of personalities and expectations and skepticism.
Right.
But
well, you had an opportunity to sort of view and evaluate the actions of staff members, both COs, mm-hmm. Custody officers, corrections officers, as well as, in a limited way, the healthcare staff.
Mm-hmm.
What did you find was the most helpful type of personality or interaction? You had several examples of people we would not want our staff members to emulate, but,
mm-hmm.
but you have. I think that for nurses who are often, geared toward the kind of care you give in a nursing home or acute care, and that's
right.
very much identified as hands-off, that's not how you care for an inmate patient. There's usually this
mm-hmm.
disconnect they want you to have, and yet you need to be caring in that environment. What have you found to be maybe some of the characteristics of people who were successful at that?
Well, I think that one of the clinicians who was best liked and had a really, from the prisoner's point of view, a really phenomenal attitude was the dentist who
okay.
worked with the unit that I lived in. And he, I think, had been there for a long time. And, I don't really know what to say about him as a clinician other than that, he provided good care. He pulled a lot of teeth, to be honest. But, he had a very positive attitude in dealing and interacting with inmates. And, for someone like myself, basically I had a cleaning, which was fine. And, his feedback to me was consistent with that of every other dentist I've ever had. Like, you need to floss more. But, but you also did occasionally see him deliver, not just triage care, like a tooth needs to be pulled, but some additional care. For example, there was a young woman I was friends with who whose teeth had been seriously, seriously damaged by her drug use, and he was able to really improve, both her oral health and also, frankly, her appearance. And, psychologically, that makes an incredible difference. And
right.
can potentially have a real impact on the person's prospects when they go home. So to see something like that take place was really, really heartening. And, he's a person who is a good example, sort of well-liked. The spectrum, the kind of folks who we generally came in contact in that setting, in that federal setting, there was one dentist, there was one psychiatrist who would generally only appear in my unit about once a week. The day-to-day care was generally provided by physician's assistants and occasionally by doctors. And then there were many, many instances where there was an acute situation, whether it was a person who had cancer or a person who had injured themselves. Often that care was provided out of the facility at the local hospital. Though it did depend. And that was generally where things got most contentious, is when, let's say, a patient has been diagnosed with cancer and is trying to advocate for their own health care. It's an incredibly difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the setting, the condition of being a prisoner is not a condition that lends itself to patient advocacy on their own behalf.
Right.
Or to gaining in that sort of setting, to gaining really concrete information about their medical condition. And that's a scary thing. And then, of course, you factor in as well the fact that a lot of folks in prison don't necessarily have the education or the language. You know, for me to sit and talk to a physician or a clinician, you know, I can ask a lot of questions on my own behalf that a lot of other folks that I was locked up with could not necessarily do. But, you know, generally sort of that core attitude, that sort of sense of, you know, I am in fact here to help you, as opposed to, you know, I'm going to make the assumption that you're malingering and wasting my time, which did come through from some of the medical staff. That makes a big difference, and really makes a big difference. And, you know, there are folks, I mean, especially with some of the mental health issues, there are folks who, there are repetitive issues and problems which may not be acute medical problems. And I'm sure that it is frustrating for a clinician to deal with that, but that's definitely a reality of that setting.
Right. You have to kind of know your population and therefore expect and handle that. Good point. Well, I've seen in prison unusual, but not, but a positive effect on the women in having been taken away from their usual situation and pulled into this environment, maybe an opportunity for them to reflect on their life or shift and take an alternative route. Did you see that working out in some of the lives of the women you were with?
Well, I mean, it's sort of an interesting and sometimes heartbreaking question. Many of the women that I was in prison with come from our most vulnerable communities, our most unsafe communities, and frankly, as women, are perhaps more unsafe in some ways than other, than, you know, some of the men in those communities. I think of my friend Pom Pom, who I write about in the book, who, you know, a young woman in her early 20s, who, you know, who I liked a lot and was sort of a good worker and had a good attitude and was respectful towards other prisoners, sort of all of the basics that you might expect, but, you know, a good person. And I remember she went home before I did and sent me a letter, and it was a heartbreaking letter because it basically talked about the fact that she was afraid to go out and that, you know, she didn't really have enough food and didn't really have a support system that she had any trust in or any significant ability to lean on to help her through her reentry process. So ironically, you know, prison was probably a safer and more stable environment for her to live in than the neighborhood that she returned to. And that's a scary reality.
And a sad commentary on our society.
It's a terrible thing. I think that a prison setting is a highly structured setting, and there are folks who do benefit from a highly structured setting. But again, back to that question of continuity, you know, when folks return home, they generally are going straight back to the setting, to a very different kind of setting. And that's a significant, significant problem. So sometimes folks have been able to draw upon, you know, reserves of strength and develop themselves within the prison setting. And I frankly would say basically on their own steam, not because the system is really also encouraging of personal growth
or
development.
Right. Oh, definitely. Definitely.
But, you know, I think those systemic forces are really, really powerful, whether you're talking about economic forces or whether you're talking about, you know, factors like stress or, you know, mental and behavioral health issues. And so, you know, we would do well not to just lay all of our hope on personal responsibility or individual growth, but to really think much more critically and intentionally about creating more continuity, especially in that reentry point. I mean, I do think also that alternatives to incarceration for, you know, low-level nonviolent offenders would be an incredible an incredibly productive way of reapportioning resources, because the stigma and some of the real legal barriers that happen once you actually have been a prisoner are considerable. And so if we're able to divert people rather than locking them up and still maintain public safety, then I think that's something that will serve everybody well, and not just those offenders or their families.
Well, it's a sad commentary that it's the economy that's making us look at those options, but at least we are, it appears, looking on many levels at options other than incarceration for some of these low-level crimes. So that's great.
Silver lining.
Right. We'll go for it. Well, what was the silver lining for you in your prison experience? Did it, would you say it changed the direction of your life or the relationships that you've had? How's that impacted you?
I mean, it definitely changed a lot of the ways that I think about my life and some of the opportunities and privileges that I've enjoyed throughout my life in comparison with that of other Americans. And I think for many middle-class Americans, the reality of life for poor Americans is a total abstraction or completely unreal. And so I think that, having lived in that setting for 1 year, I have a much more concrete and, I think, accurate understanding of what so many people in this country have to contend with and the factors that land them in prison in the first place. It's not just bad intentions. And so that's
right.
Something that, you know, I can't really, that's a revelation that I can't really put behind me and not talk about, which is part of the motivation in writing the book.
Yeah. Well, I think the time that you've spent on this issue and the publication of the book is great. It really does open up your eyes to and make that experience very real to those of us who haven't had it. So I really appreciate your publication of the book.
Great. Well, when you say that, you just make me feel like I succeeded in what I set out to do. So that makes me feel fantastic.
Well, great. And I hope plenty of people get an opportunity to read it. And I've enjoyed your insights, and thank you so much for the great conversation.
Oh, thank you for the interview, Lori. I really appreciate you inviting me to come onto the show.
Well, thank you all for joining us today. Be sure to favorite the show from Correctional Nursing Today page of blogtalkradio.com. In our next episode, I'll be interviewing Sue Smith. She's a correctional nurse, and we'll be talking about issues of failure to rescue in correctional nursing. That show's going to air August 19th. So until next time, make today count for good. We're going to do the same here at Correctional Nursing Today.